With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
It's Thursday the 23rd of April. This is On the Continent on Football Ramble Daily. I'm Luke Moore.
And I'm Andy Brassel.
Okay then, welcome Andy. Good morning, how are you?
Yes, I'm well. And your good self?
Very, very good, thank you. No complaints at all from me. I wouldn't even dream of it. Before we get into today's show, which will feature some piping hot European football chat, I want to remind everyone that if they're Patreon subscribers, they have access to even more European football content in the form of the Mailbag Show, hosted by our pal Marcus Speller and co-hosted by you, Mr. Andy. A chance for all you enthusiasts to ask questions of the team and have them answered. So if there's anything you want an answer to, that's the place to do it. Head to patreon.com/footballrambledaily to get access for as little as $5 a month. There's also several other pieces of exclusive content, a Discord server for you to chat with fellow Football Ramble Daily subscribers, and chances to win genuinely very good prizes as well. That's patreon.com/footballrambledaily. Andy, give us a quick flavour of a highlight or two of what you've been talking about on the Mailbag recently.
Well, we've had all sorts of stuff, really. What were we talking about last week? We were talking about all the weeks kind of blend into one at the moment.
We talked a bit about Roma, and we'll come on to them a bit later as well, actually.
Yeah, we talked about the potential Roma takeover, which we'll touch on here later. We talked about the joys or otherwise of surrounding yourself as a regime with players from your own country that are not players from the country that the league that is part of the league you're playing in. So the question was with reference to Wolves, but of course there were loads of other examples from all over Europe. But yeah, you can just get involved on Discord. I pop up on Discord every now and then for a little chat as well. In fact, I'm going to go into the gaming part later to see if I can get any FIFA 20 tips, because I keep getting panelled by my 8-year-old.
Yeah, I get panelled by everyone on that game. The other thing you guys did, actually I really enjoyed recently, was greatest relegation escapes in Europe. That was really interesting.
Yeah, that was a terrific question, wasn't it?
Yeah, check that out over at patreon.com/footballrambledaily. Coming up today, we'll talk to Preben Rockier, who's a marketing director at FC Midtjylland in Denmark, about a drive-in football story you heard on Monday here on Football Ramble Daily. Andy spoke to him earlier and got a bit further context on that. Very interesting. We'll also look at the latest regarding a takeover at Roma, as Andy's already said. And we'll hear the latest about the salary deferments at the club as well. But first, shall we dive into the current Champions League and Europa League plans then? As things stand, here we are today on the 23rd of April. The latest idea is to play remaining fixtures in these competitions in August after the completion of domestic seasons. This is complicated, however, by authorities outside of football setting the policy. For example, the Prime Minister of the Netherlands, Mark Rutte, has cancelled all public events until September, which effectively means the 2019-20 Eredivisie season is done. There are no Netherlands clubs left in the two European competitions, but it shows the problem in principle. If that sort of edict is passed down in other countries, they won't be able to finish their season, and that UEFA idea is essentially toast. Is that accurate, Andy?
I'm not sure it means the UEFA idea is toast, but it does mean they'll have to be adaptable, which is something that Alexander Seferin has recognised all along and has re-recognised this week, if that's the correct phrase. I mean, you talked about the principal problem, even though the Netherlands don't have any representatives left in the two European competitions, because, of course, it looks like the Scottish Premiership is likely to be called off as well. And Rangers are still in the Europa League, if only just after losing the first leg to Bayer Leverkusen. So you've got the possible situation where Rangers don't play a domestic game until, say, September, and they still have to get themselves out there for a Europa League game at some point. And you know, I don't know whether that would turn it into a sort of pre-season warm-up for them, given their position in the tie at the moment. But as you say, it does sort of underline the potential problems. And I think that's the thing. Like, we've said it again and again on OTC, the fact that the football authorities need to try and contingency plan for what's happening and for what is a major negative economic event. There's no getting away from that when we're talking, as we have done in previous weeks, about the future of the clubs and the future of football on the continent. There's always going to have to be a degree of flexibility to the plans, because they're all incredibly fragile. We know stuff can change, and we know that when the first one of these leagues or competitions comes back, there will be unforeseen problems that pop up. That is almost inevitable. And in a way, I think this works quite nicely for UEFA, because they give the clubs support, and maybe some of those problems can get ironed out while the domestic leagues come back. So there's some best practice to take back when they go back into the Champions League and the Europa League in August.
So Andy, if some leagues finish at different times or are not completed in some cases but are completed in others, how will it be determined which clubs represent their leagues in UEFA competition going forward? So what I mean by that is, will it be a uniform decision across the board by UEFA who say these leagues at this point had these finishing positions, so that's who gets to represent you in the Champions League or the Europa League, or will there have to be a completely different solution?
Luke, it looks as if that is what the point of this week's UEFA teleconference meeting is. So as we're recording, later on Thursday, 23rd of April, there will be a meeting between all the different national associations. And as we were saying, it's all quite fragile, of course. So there's no sense that there'll be definite dates given for the return of the Champions League and the Europa League. What it does look like doing is UEFA setting out the basis on which European places will be distributed if the leagues finish and if they can't go forward. And it seems, for example, that losing cup finalists will not be admitted. It will just be done on league places. So France at the moment, for example, it would be rather than Lyon or Saint-Étienne, who you both have to assume, if the cup finals happen, the Coupe de France and the Coupe de la Ligue would go on to lose to Paris Saint-Germain, they would not be admitted to the Europa League. It would just be the top five that stands. Now, of course, this brings up another thing when we're talking about the example of France, because there's an unequal amount of games played at the moment. So, like Lyon, who have qualified for European competition the last 22 years, I think, as stands, they're seventh. And if the league were to finish now, and France hopes to start again on June 17th, though there's some consternation between the league and the players' union on the terms of the resumption, so that's something to watch. Lyon wouldn't be in European competition. But what they would say is, or what I suspect they would say, is because Strasbourg versus Paris Saint-Germain was postponed due to concern about the onset of the pandemic in Alsace just before the whole league stopped, they would go back to the last completed round, and at the end of that, Lyon were fifth. So that is the way they try to put it. Now, that is something for the domestic league to sort out. It's up to the individual domestic leagues to sort out what the places are. But then, once you've got those final places, how they will be distributed is something that would be a UEFA edict, it seems.
So complicated, isn't it? I mean, there's lots of different clubs in lots of different situations. That Lyon one there, you said there, I hadn't even considered that before, because PSG and Strasbourg haven't played each other, so that round isn't complete. Everyone, not everyone, but a lot of clubs are going to have a little problem with certain situations, aren't they? And there's going to be, I mean, would there be lobbying being involved? I mean, is it going to be done with consultation of the clubs? Because we know that in the UK, sorry, in England, in the Premier League, 14 clubs need to agree to something for it to go through. Is it similar roughly in other countries?
I can't tell you, Luke, how disappointed I am, because I thought we'd explain that perfectly, and you get to the end and go, "Oh no, it's really complicated."
It's really it probably says more about me than anything else. But what I mean is, so I suppose let me clarify my question further. So what I mean is, if the league decide whatever they decide, and in some cases it will come down from a governmental authority, but if the league has to decide that within those parameters passed down by the government, will there be lobbying internally from different clubs' representatives for the best outcome for their club?
Of course there will, and there has been all along. You know, there's no doubt about that. I mean, another thing that came up in France this week, and when you're talking about complication, is that two of the presidents, Jean-Michel Aulas, yes, him again, from Lyon, and Jean-Pierre Rivère of Nice, said, why don't we complete the league September to December and then start the league in the next calendar year? So we just go to, you know, almost an old Russian model, what they used to do, play the game over the summer. And the rest of the presidents were like, geez, come on. You know, this is complicated enough anyway. Yeah. What are you trying to do? And the whole point, I think when we come back to this UEFA thing, it's about the top leagues and their TV deals. That's the major thing, isn't it? That they need to be able, those clubs in Germany, Spain, Italy, England, they need to get to a point where they're covered money-wise. You know, they can't be letting... you know, several hundred millions of TV money go. It's important for them, even the biggest clubs, to support themselves going forward. Whereas, you know, we've heard the presidents of Ajax and Vitesse in the Netherlands say, well, we're not so reliant on TV money as them, so we're not really in the same boat. Belgium, they were covered for force majeure, so they're going to get most of their money. The broadcasters will get most of their money back through insurance. So it's fine. There's not quite the same imperative to complete the season. But so many of these little things will come up. And as you say, Luke, some of them are things that we can see now, that we're discussing now. And there will be so many other things, not just from a hygiene perspective. But for example, let's go to La Liga. Let's say La Liga start on one of those dates that Javier Tebas wants to restart, and mid-June La Liga restarts. Sevilla playing at home June, July. How is that going to work? I mean, it gets to like 50 degrees there. They're going to have to kick off at midnight or something like that. And I'm actually not joking. You know, that they will be kicking off, I reckon, like 11 p.m. or something like that. Some would say La Liga have been there before and on a Monday night. But it's something, these are all little things that are going to crop up. So whatever the plan is, in an ever-changing environment, there are always going to be, it's going to be like whack-a-mole. There are going to be so many other things that all the different leagues and UEFA are going to have to deal with.
Mm. All right. Well, one country that could be the first to restart is Germany. Dates are to be confirmed, but it's looking like it could be next month, perhaps as early as May 9th, although there's a meeting on Thursday about it, and a more likely start date is either the 16th or the 23rd of May. It'll be behind closed doors, obviously, and there will be a health and safety task force that's been set up. Your mate's dad will hate that, by the way. Health and safety, hell in a handcuff. to ensure that strict behaviours are followed, particularly when it comes to away teams staying in hotels. Kicker in Germany covered this, and there were some amazing instructions. Everything from not pressing the lift button with your finger to banning players from any sort of hotel buffet. There's also advice on minimal staffing, and lots of services you'd expect from a hotel just simply won't be available. There was an interesting story on the BBC website about it this morning, about how they'll actually go about bringing it back logistically, and as you'd expect, testing is front and centre, and that is well worth a read if you get a chance. Germany, who haven't been hit as hard by this virus as other places in Europe, Andy, looking like they may be the first to come back, and it could well be that all the eyes of the football supporting world are going to be on Germany maybe around this time next month.
Yes, it does, and it sounds like one heck of an away trip, doesn't it? With just all that stuff around hotel instructions. I mean, one of the other ones was that there was a defined optimal temperature for players'
and humidity.
Rooms. That's right. It had to be between 50% and 60% humidity and no more. I mean, all the other stuff, like, you know, they're not allowed to go to the bar. What the hell would they be doing going to the bar on an away trip anyway? I think you'd have the hump, wouldn't you? It's not the 1970s anymore. But I think in terms of plans, even advanced plans being fragile, this story that you're talking about on the BBC website, which has been taken from story that broke late last night in the German media, it's a sort of leaked plan about how match days themselves would unroll. So it's like the next part of the plan. And, you know, the stuff in terms of the major thing that's been focused on is if a player tested positive, you wouldn't necessarily quarantine the whole group. You'd just test them. And it's not that specific about the point where you actually would test them. Like, you wouldn't test them on the way into the stadium. It would maybe be a couple of days before, or there'd be two tests in the week before the game or whatever. It's something that is constantly evolving. And of course, the fact that it's not indefinite leaves it open to criticism. So I think that shows really that the football authorities, even in a case like Germany, where they've managed to flatten the curve well, things are still developing and things are still changing. And, you know, people have said as well the fact that you know, there's a possibility, as you say, if it's starting on May the 9th, and it's not until April 30th that Angela Merkel gets together with the 16 governors of all the federal states and decides how they're going to go forward with the next stage of moving on and paring down social distancing and all that, because, you know, there's not full contact training yet, and you want 3 weeks of full contact training. So there've been special training guidelines released so they can up the intensity of the training, because they want as much training in as possible before it actually restarts. So there are so many moving parts, even for a country that, you know, I think Merkel put it as, we've got a fragile progression in terms of what we're trying to do. And I think her use of the word fragile is very interesting, I think, for a political leader to use that, and very wise in these circumstances. But I think it shows that, you know, so much of this is having to be made up on the fly. At the moment, they just have to have this list that looks absolutely exhaustive and then pare down from there. But as I said, other things will come up.
Yeah, and there's been a bit of pushback from one or two politicians who were saying that, you know, the amount of tests you would need to do this would perhaps mean that more needy people wouldn't get the tests because they're being used elsewhere. According to that news report, there are 640,000 tests available per week in Germany. The Bundesliga and second division would require about 0.5% of those tests to fulfill their plan. And there's been a bit of a discussion in Germany about whether that's actually morally correct. But the thing is, the other side of that is that, you know, there are 50,000 or circa 50,000 workers, employees that rely on the football industry for their jobs. And with the exception of Sky Germany, who I think have agreed in principle to honour their final instalment of broadcasting rights, DAZN, ARD, ZDF have not paid yet. And it looks like it's going to be around maybe under 250 million euros, something like that, of money that's being held back as things stand. And a lot, as I said, a lot of people's jobs rely on that. So it's a real balancing act. We expect to see more information, as I've said, in the meeting on Thursday. And then on the 30th, there'll be another meeting with decision makers, and we'll see a little bit more clarity then. But it does look like Germany are far closer to coming back again behind closed doors than a lot of other leagues around Europe.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
There was an interesting story that came to light over the weekend, and we covered it on Monday's Ramble, and that's an idea of drive-in football at FC Midtjylland in Denmark. It's an example of a different approach to fans watching games. It piqued our interest, so we thought it would be nice to talk to Midtjylland's marketing director, Preben Rokkia, and hear more about that. Andy caught up with him earlier and asked him how it all came about.
We tried to have a very close discussion with our fans all the time, and we have a very creative media department inside FC Midtjylland as well. And when we have this kind of situation where we all agree that we have to take care of each other, we've been trying to say, then what could be the second best to seeing football on the stadium? And then we agreed that we should put up a lot of ideas, and then we found that this was the best idea. We thought that this could be something that could unite people, not standing shoulder to shoulder, but sitting car to car, watching football together.
And so have other clubs been in touch with you since the idea became public knowledge? Obviously, people have been talking about it all over Europe and all over the world. Have other clubs from Denmark and abroad been in touch to ask for help and advice and how they might do a similar scheme?
We have seen a few clubs trying to do something similar. And we have also had a few clubs asking how they could do it in a way that would be similar to the way we're doing it. But the most funny thing, I think, was that we had a baseball team from Washington in the U.S. asking a lot of different details about how could they do the drive-in thing at their place.
Well, I suppose the drive-through experience makes sense in terms of America, doesn't it? I mean, apparently some American cinemas, some American drive-ins have been doing quite good business. So this is something that could work well.
Yeah, we've been talking to some clubs, but the crazy thing has been that we thought that this was a good idea in our region, perhaps in our country. But we're discussing this all over the world. Tomorrow I'm going to be in a morning show in Japan. The day after that, it's an evening show in Australia. I'm talking to you. I've been interviewed to a Polish TV station. It's really gone crazy.
So Midtjylland in its current form is quite a new club. In terms of creating an idea about this, I mean, you talked about the closeness to the fans and taking the fans' ideas on board. Is the fact that you've got quite a new infrastructure something that makes this easier to roll out as well?
You could say so. We have a quite young club, and we are in an area of Denmark where nothing really is given. We have no water. We have no mountains. We are not that many people. So everybody is kind of sticking together. And when you come with this kind of idea to the local authorities and to the police and to everybody else in the region, it's not a question of getting a permission. It's a question of how are we going to solve this together? So suddenly it's also a task for the police and a task for the local council. And we're all working together. And this is really tremendous in this part of Denmark.
So what has been the sort of prep that you've had to do for it, Preben? What are the practical steps that you have to take to make this from a great story to something that actually happens and is a great experience for the supporters?
First of all, we are mounting up a 46 square meter screen in front of the stadium. And we are mounting up an even larger screen, 52 square meters, at the back of the stadium. Then we're having around 700 cars in the front, and around 1,500 in the back, meaning 2,200 cars in all. we have the possibility around the stadium to build it up to 12,500 cars. So we have a very special facility here. Wow. And then we'll be transmitting the game, of course, on the screen as it is played. And the sound, when you go into the stadium, we have registered a special frequency. And then when you're tuning into this, you will do. You can do that in your car radio, and then you will hear the commentators talking about the match in your car. What we also is doing is that we're putting up microphones and cameras in the big screen cameras. Oh, sorry, in the big screens. So then we're transmitting what's happening on the parking lot inside the stadium. So the players and the staff inside the stadium will be able to see and hear what's happening outside the stadium. So that's a special part of it. And then when we're finished talking here, I have a meeting with our special our different fan sectors in order to find out what can we do. Can we make something special out of the horns? Do we make carnival about how you decorate your car into a FC Midtjylland car? And so on and so forth. So we really try to make this an event that people would say, okay, it was a big news when it came out, but it's even bigger when we see it.
It sounds amazing, but I've got to ask, what about the boring practical stuff? What about drinks and if fans need to go to the toilet and stuff like that? What happens?
I could give you a couple of examples about drinks. First of all, it's alcohol free. We agreed with that with the police because we're a little bit worried that everybody stays in the cars and that everybody's going. A lot of people is going to drive home afterwards. When it comes to going to the restroom, we urge people to do that before coming. But we will also have restrooms at the facilities. And if you blink your light, then a safety guard will come down. Escort you to a toilet, afterwards clean it and escort you back to the car again.
Well, that's fantastic. I mean, how important do you think it will be for the players to have that feeling of closeness to the fans, that they're there even though they're not there in the stands? Have you spoken to the players about that? Reaction to it?
I've spoken a lot to the players and the first thing they said, no matter what you find out, everything is better than the last game we played without any fans at the stadium. And they think this is a great idea. It, for all of us, it's a little bit difficult to imagine how it's going to play out because nobody of us have tried this before. But I'm you can be sure that there will be a lot of activities, and a lot of activities will be focused on connecting from the field inside the stadium to the 50 meters outside the stadium in order to secure that everybody knows that something is happening on both sides of the fence.
And finally, Preben, having organized this drive-in football project, you might be organizing a similar project, but in terms of parading a championship trophy in a couple of months.
Yeah.
Is that something that people have in the back of their minds at the club?
No doubt that what we're hoping is, it's quite sure we will not play with fans on the stadium at this time. That's more or less for sure. So what we're hoping is that we are having 12,000 cars outside the stadium with 15 or 16 different large screens, and that we're having a party without compromising what is the government's plan for the country.
It's fascinating stuff, Andy, isn't it? And the thing that really piqued my interest as well there is the idea that Midtjylland are currently 12 points clear at the top of the table in Denmark, and the talk of them lifting a trophy is quite interesting.
It really is. And well, maybe if they do get to those title celebrations, if we're allowed out by then, what do you reckon? A little at the match, Luke?
Yeah, your car or mine?
I think it'll have to be yours because yours has, I would say, slightly more comfortable seats and definitely a better stereo system.
All right, I'll let you beep the horn when they lift the trophy.
I mean, there's no point us listening to the Danish commentary, is there? So we might as well just sit in there listening to MF Doom or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. You can hear an extended version of that interview, by the way, slightly longer, over on our Patreon as part of the Ramble On episode that will come out in the coming days. There's a few other bits and pieces in there about what's going on at the club and how Danish football broadly is dealing with the crisis. So if you want to hear the extended version of that, it's part of Ramble On. The URL to sign up, as I gave to you at the top of the show, is patreon.com/footballrambledaily.
Sometimes winner, sometimes loss. I have many difficult. Mami work 12 hours, 15 hours a day in the VAC. My job and my players is not touch.
In addition to Germany, Italy may now have a consensus to resume. In a meeting recently, all 20 Serie A clubs signalled an intention to complete the 19-20 season, government allowing. This is a change from the last meeting they had, in which Sampdoria, Torino and Brescia all opposed attempting to finish it. In their statement, the league included the phrase, in compliance with medical protocols for the protection of players and all professionals, and it's hoped they can start to train again in May, even if it takes until the autumn. The FIGC and the clubs are committed to finishing the league. That's roughly in line with the UEFA protocol, but again, the Italian football authorities are at the mercy of the Italian government, Andy, aren't they? And Italy's been hit very, very, very hard by this pandemic, as we know. So it's going to be very tentative and very, very careful when they do make any decision.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think it's interesting that one of the voices we've heard most in the last week in Italy is that of Vincenzo Spadafora, who's the Minister for Sport. So it feels like he's leading it, which seems entirely appropriate. And, you know, he's focused on the economic aspect of it, as well as, you know, the morale aspect of it as well. And, you know, he said something that's very interesting, the fact that, you know, football doesn't only correspond to Serie A, and, you know, sport just isn't just football. So, you know, it's bringing home the fact that sport is part of national life, as well as the fact that it's economically necessary, as we've been saying, for lots of the top leagues to try and get back on the road again if they can. I mean, still there's some doubt in terms of venues, because there's been a talk that they might, say, omit the whole of Piedmont, for example, and just try and play the games in central Italy. Now, quite how that would work out, I mean, you know, there's been speculation on how the events might be pared down in a lot of countries. I mean, there was even talk in Spain a couple of days ago about how Real Madrid, rather than play their games at the Bernabeu, might play their games at Valdebebas, the training ground, and take it from there, where they've sort of got a mini stadium, a bit like Barcelona's mini Estadi, or, you know, like a lot of clubs, Manchester City have something similar, don't they? A sort of 2,000 capacity sort of training stadium there. And in Real Madrid's case, not to take it too far away from Italy, that would also give them the opportunity to start getting the drop on the building work they want to do on the Bernabeu. And they could get a period of time where they would work through to, I think, September to start on what is going to be, well, eventually an absolutely phenomenal construction. I don't know if you've seen the plans for that.
The plans are unbelievable. They're spectacular.
Yeah, they really are. So there's still a lot of things to figure out. But the fact that you've got a date of May the 4th put out there, that is the date when Italy as a country is expected to start paring down the restrictions in terms of going out and social distancing, etc., etc. And it seems there's already a reduction in the amount of new infections, that would be the point where they could start training again. And you've seen at the weekend, I think Miralem Pjanic of Juventus posted a picture on Instagram saying going back to work, and it was him getting on a plane flying back to Turin. So, you know, the players are ready for this. And I think the main thing is what you said at the top there is absolutely right to point out the fact that at last there seems a consensus, there seems a desire to finish that there wasn't before. And I think that's totally understandable from, you know, we've talked so much about the financial side of that. And I think that is right because people still want football clubs there at the end. And a lot of people, not just us, but people who work in ticket offices and work at stadiums, at groundsmen and all the rest of it, rely on football for their work. But with Italy, I think so much of it has been, if you go back, I reckon even like 2 to 3 weeks, there's just not an appetite for football to come back. And you look at groups of ultras saying, why would we, you know, people are dying. How can we think about football? You can't minimize that. That's absolutely huge. And I think when you look at, say, we were talking about the Netherlands before, the reaction in the Netherlands, there has never been any will amongst the players or the clubs for the season to continue. And so when Mark Rutte came out with that saying, right, there can't be any major events, and that includes, you know, any competitive sports or any games behind closed doors or anything like that, it was kind of a relief, I think, to the league and most of the clubs in it, because there was, I think, whereas the financial aspect is important, and we've said from the beginning, it sounds heartless to say, but the reality is protecting football clubs and protecting people's futures is important. You can't overlook the emotional aspect of it. And I think so much of this has to be led by that, like the desire to actually have it back. And it's not for us to tell, or anyone to tell other countries, individual countries, when that feels right or when that feels appropriate.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's got to come from them themselves, particularly in somewhere like Italy. It's been hit so hard. It's a very difficult balancing act, isn't it? Just as a broadcaster, let alone as a decision maker, where you think, look, let's be absolutely clear. Over 25,000 people have lost their lives to this in Italy alone. It's a huge amount of people. It's every single one of those is a tragedy and should be mourned and not forgotten. But at the same time, in addition to that, there is an understanding, and I think there should be an understanding, that there are a lot of jobs at stake. There are a lot of people's livelihoods at stake. And while those deaths are the most important thing and the most tragic thing about this, at some point, I think we all agree that the world will have to continue. It's just about getting that aspect right and being sensitive enough to the situation to not be seen or to not do anything that's going to be offensive or heartless or insensitive to the situation. And you're absolutely right, Andy. It's got to come from the people themselves. It shouldn't be passed down from up on high, but from people who have a kind of one-size-fits-no-one approach and have no in-depth knowledge or information of the area itself, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's fair to say. But the fact that this is quite new in terms of the league's clubs coming together and saying, right, okay, we're prepared to get on with this and we're prepared to finish this at some point. We've already seen further preparation in that direction. Like I know Manchester United, for example, have said it seems that both Chris Smalling and Henrik Mkhitaryan will be able to carry on past June the 30th when their loan spells were due to expire and be at Roma's disposal after that point. You know, these are all things that are coming together still. And that's why the stuff about, you know, where the games are actually going to take place is still under discussion, because, you know, this is only a very new state of mind.
Yeah, absolutely. Will we go and have a look at one of the more interesting stories in Italy as well, as far as Roma? I mean, the players and the coach, Paolo Fonseca at Roma, have agreed to forego their salaries for 4 months, March, April, May and June, to save the club an estimated €32 million. Subscribers to our Patreon, as I said, Andy, will have heard you on the latest from the Friedkin Group's potential takeover of the club, something that's obviously stalled due to the ongoing pandemic. Can you give us a quick précis of the situation there, both on the salary foregoing, unless I've covered it in its entirety already, and the takeover?
Well, I think let's go for the takeover first, Luke, because... Okay.
Treat it like a buffet, mate. Like a buffet that a German footballer would not be allowed to be at. You just take the bits you want, and we'll work out the rest later.
I'll help myself because they're not allowed to.
A safe buffet because it's done remotely.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. This is too early in the day to make me hungry. I think the takeover is interesting because it was so close. I mean, we were talking on Jules and Andy earlier this week about the Newcastle United takeover. The Roma takeover.
Don't open that can of worms, blimey.
Amnesty aren't getting involved in this. There's no such concerns. I mean, it was about Roma moving from American ownership with James Pallotta to more American ownership with Dan Friedkin. So we were further along the line than, say, Newcastle. Are at the moment, even if it seems just a case of the fit and proper persons test for them, because everything's agreed. The Friedkin Group and representatives were going over to Rome to sign off on the deal, and then Serie A stopped, and so the Friedkin said, "Well, you know what? Let's just say stop for the moment." And but this, it seems, is put Pallotta's nose out of joint a little bit, and that's the last we've heard of it for the moment, because I guess, you know, how can you sign off on a deal that big when you've got this amount of uncertainty, and especially Roma, whose finances have been very up and down in recent years. There's the fact that for Pallotta it is a pain, of course, because he was set to make an absolutely enormous profit on this sale, and he'd grown quite frustrated with trying to get things in place for the new Stadio di Roma, the new ground, which would, you know, they've done the same thing pay-wise as Juventus, but this would be them commercially aping Juventus, because they'd have their own stadium of a bigger size than Juventus, actually, and they'd have corporate facilities, be able to have concerts there, all that sort of stuff, and they'd actually be making the money because they wouldn't be renting it as most clubs in Italy do. The stadiums are municipally owned and they pay rent, so that would have been it, and still I think eventually will be a huge fillip for Roma. But there's a feeling that Pallotta had grown quite tired of this. I mean, it was meant to actually open in 2016. And, you know, they haven't even signed it off yet. It must have been part of the deal to sell it to Friedkin, to say, you know, this is your opportunity. You know, you can make the club something incredible. And Friedkin seems to have bought into that. But given the finances...
Andy, is that why the price is so high? Sorry to cut in, but is that why the price is so high? Because to me, I mean, people who look at the deal, which is, what is it, just a shade under $900 million?
Yes.
Is it... To me, I was astonished to see how high that price was for a club in Serie A. But perhaps on my opinion is just completely out of date on that. To me, it seemed like a very high price. But would the stadium kind of go some way towards explaining that?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Because you look at the commercial potential, I think, for Roma. That's what it would have been sold on. But not knowing how much debt this crisis is going to create. And when you bear in mind it's a club that, in terms of salary, has only really pared back in the last couple of years. When you look at the amount of big earners that have gone, like Totti, De Rossi, and that's before you get to selling Strootman and Nainggolan. And it's a younger team under Paolo Fonseca. I think the Friedkins are right to wait. If we look at the pay itself, it's quite interesting to see Roma come out actually this week and give this statement and saying, Edin Dzeko's our captain and we're definitely not going to sell him, despite the speculation that he might move on this summer. I mean, he's 34 now. He nearly went to Inter. a couple of years ago, and
Chelsea as well.
yeah, that's right. Sorry, into last year it was Chelsea before that, wasn't it? And I think it's very important for them to come out and say this at the moment, because not only have all those senior players moved on, and that is why Dzeko is the captain, and of course Alessandro Florenzi, who went off on loan to Valencia in the last transfer window, and Valencia have an option to complete on that deal, although that's one of myriad deals that's threatened by the whole situation at the moment. For them to hold on to someone who's experienced, bankable, recognisable, consistent, and all of those things are important. But I think it's particularly important at the moment because the push to do what Juventus have done, go without pay for those 4 months, not take a pay cut, go without pay for those 4 months. And yes, if it resumes, they're eligible to get some of it back and all the rest of it. And to pay the workers at the club their full salary, the people who we were saying before who work in the offices at the club and the ground staff and all those sort of people. Dzeko has been a leader of this. Him and Paulo Fonseca, who's taken to life in Rome very well, and he talked about it in the Portuguese media recently, how much he loves it. Roma were very, very keen to stress how much Dzeko led the players and how much Dzeko got everyone on board with that. So the idea that he would leave after that just does seem a bit ridiculous. Will they move on from him on the pitch at some point? Yeah, I would have thought so, because, you know, he's getting on a bit. He's got a lot of miles on the clock, although he's been very good this season, I might add. But what he represents for Roma in terms of a figurehead as they're trying to move into this new era under Paulo Fonseca is very important, and people are full of praise for what he's done in this particular situation where the whole squad have done a good thing, really, for the benefit of the club as a whole.
Interesting times at Roma. We'll watch that with interest. I mean, Andy, I wouldn't mind finishing off this week, if you don't mind, with a bit of chat about Monaco, who've had a kind of up and down last couple of years after a bit of success over in France. They've been through five or six coaches in the last season and two-thirds or whatever it is. Although under Robert Moreno, they find themselves a little bit more resurgent. They were, I think, mid-table at the time football stopped, but they were on the march, weren't they? But unfortunately, it looks like they've fallen into difficult times with re-money. They want to go beyond statutory wage cuts, and they've even gone as far as to ask the royal family for help. Can you give me, chiefly, but also, of course, our listeners, the skinny on what's happening over in Monaco?
They've got an issue because, of course, they've been wage cuts already of about 25%. Now, we have to say a lot of clubs in France are having trouble agreeing wage cuts across the board. And, you know, this is something that in a lot of European countries...
Yeah, it looks like most places that's happening, really.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of footballers have been criticised for this because the public perception, or a large part of the public's perception, which I can fully understand, is you get a load of money, can't you just give it up? But it's not about that, I think, for the majority of footballers. And it's about doing the right thing versus being seen to do the right thing. Because being seen to do the right thing, the obvious thing is just saying, yeah, all right then. And then there you go. But as a player, and in an era where players take more and more responsibility for their legacy and their social impact, you want to know where the money's going. And you want to know, as in terms of English Premier League players, for example, if I am not paying as much tax, will that affect the emergency authorities? You want to know all that stuff, and that's fair enough. The situation at Monaco is slightly different because we've got this fact that everyone gets 20% taken off. Because that's what the government decrees. Well, it's 16% in France, and it's 20% in Monaco, because of course Monaco is a separate country. We've got to underline that. And this is what it comes down to: the fact that Monaco's model is so different, because of course in terms of match day revenue they're not really losing that much, but what they do have is an absolutely enormous wage bill. They have the second biggest wage bill in Ligue 1 behind Paris Saint-Germain. They spent nearly 200 million euros on players last summer, which I think might surprise people, because people still think of that 2017 team with Mbappe and Bakayoko and Bernardo Silva being completely dismantled. They spent a lot and it's not worked out. You know, we talked about who wouldn't get into Europe if Ligue 1 were to finish right now. Well, they wouldn't get into Europe. And they still face a battle to get into Europe, were they to come back and continue playing, as is the hope for Ligue 1. Now, what they want to do is they want players to take a further cut. Now, the fact is, if it doesn't restart, there would be a further cut compared to the consistent with the contracts that they have, and it would come down to like 50%. of their pay. But you know, I guess a lot of people in France view it as this chicken's coming home to roost a little bit, because if you sign players who come for the money, and there are a lot of players who come for the money and of course the lifestyle, because you don't get hassled in the street like you might do at other clubs or whatever, because you're
talking about Cesc Fabregas.
Well, you know, you're probably
a thinly veiled dig.
It could be any of the players, really. I mean, you know, you think you're probably in the bottom 25% of most famous people in Monaco. So, you know, go around Carrefour and do your shopping. It's fine. It's fine.
It's like Simon the Pompey, mate. Yeah.
pretty much, you know, you can go to Subway unfettered next to Fratton Park.
Exactly.
But this is something that the players' union are going to have to get involved in, because, you know, those players having come for decent money, I mean, some people will see it as mercenary, them not wanting to take huge cuts. But the fact is, the other way of looking at it is, okay, so the club's run itself in a way that if anything goes wrong, they're absolutely buggered. You know, should the players be paying the price for that? You would be asking that if you're a player. And for Monaco, it's a huge problem, because the running costs are enormous. The revenues are zero at the moment. If they don't make European competition again, you're looking at another huge swathe of finance that's cut off. And they're still carrying this massive squad where there's pretty much no one in the squad who gets paid less than 120, 150 grand a month. And that is frightening in this sort of circumstance, when you think of their lower ability than, well, I suppose you've got to compare upwards, have you, to Paris Saint-Germain, even if they're not quite at that level, because the level of revenue compared to the level of outgoing in terms of salaries, you know, it's not even comparable. So they've got a huge problem there. And at the moment, the players aren't prepared to give any more. And whereas for clubs like Marseille, who've had their financial difficulties, we know that. For Lyon, who are the direct competitors of Monaco, that's a problem for them. There's no doubt about it. But for Monaco, they need to be given this issue the hurry up. And at the moment, the players aren't budging at all, which is a huge problem for them.
It's such a difficult situation for every different club for different reasons. It's a really, really febrile time for football, isn't it? And all these different stories are really interesting, because you see almost, you know, there's 150 different clubs affected, and there's more than that. But for an example, there appears to be 150 different ways that of dealing with it, or how those problems manifest themselves. I mean, a bit morbid to say, but it's a fascinating situation, and we'll do our best to keep people across it on the continent. But I think that's about all the time we've got for this week. Andy, thank you very much for your company and your insight, as always.
Thank you, and thank you, Ramblers.
And to hear more from that interview with the marketing director of FC Michelin, then do go to our Patreon. It'll be part of the Ramble On episode this week. It's patreon.com/footballrambledaily. Loads of other stuff on there as well, as I keep saying. We'll be back tomorrow with Marcus, Jim, Pete and I for the preview show. The Blizzard Greatest Games series will return on Saturday as usual. And you might even see or hear an episode of At The Match in your podcast feed on Sunday, as well as a little bonus episode reminding you what it was like with Andy Brassel to go to football matches. It'll be bittersweet, but it does warm the cockles to hear the sound of that crowd again. So do check that out as well. Thank you for all your support through this difficult time. He's been Andy Brassel. I've been Luke Moore. We're back tomorrow. That was On The Continent. Thank you very much and see you soon.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production. We'll be right back.